Welcome to this Martin Bailey Photography Podcast, episode number 51. Welcome to episode 51. This week I'm going to continue taking a brief look at each episode to date, mentioning what was discussed and one or two of the main points from each podcast. I won't go into all of the details of the tips and techniques, of course, as it would take as long as just listening to all of the original episodes. I'm hoping that this will help to just condense all of what's been said so far, the main gist of what I've covered, and also give newcomers a brief outline of what is in the archives. There are many more pearls hiding in the old episodes, the problem is that they've just missed so much time, listening time now to catch up, that I thought I'd do this as kind of like a celebration as well of the fact that we hit 50 episodes last week. And as from next week, the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast will be 1 year old, so I think it's a good time to just sort of summarise what's happened so far. I'll also add a little update, extra information, since recording the original episodes where relevant. Hopefully for new and longer term members alike, this will give you some pointers as to what episodes you would like to go back and listen to again, or for the first time if you're a new listener. Let's pick up this week from episode 11 and see how far we can get today. In episode 11, I discussed the importance of good planning for a photography trip while discussing a 5-day trip, starting with image 731. I'm not going to go into the shooting information for each shot today either, as we need to keep this concise. If you want more details, jump to the website and check the information below the image. In this episode, I also touched on the look aspect. The success of photography that relies partially or sometimes entirely on uncontrollable aspects like the weather or that additional element to make a shot will be based on a certain amount of luck. Of course, as photographers, this may not mean having good weather, and we usually try to make the best of the situation no matter what. As we know, the best shots can be made in pretty inclement weather, and a clear blue sky often works against us more than in our favour. Good planning will enable you to hedge your bets and get you to the right place at the right time, though, with maybe the look aspect giving you the flock of birds that fly across the sunset, or a boat on a lake, or in this case, the rainbow at the foot of the waterfall. They're not always things that we plan, things that we can even possibly plan, but they make the difference between a winning shot and a mediocre one. When planning, it helps to know in which direction your intended subject is facing, so that you can get to the right place at the right time of day, so that, say if you want the sun to be on it. You'll need to find out times for sunrise and sunsets if you intend to shoot them, and ensure that you get to your location in plenty of time to prepare. Again, though, whether the sun comes over the horizon in full fiery glory, or it comes up behind a thick cloud making it invisible to us, will be down to luck in most cases. The important thing is, if you are stuck in your hotel bed at 4 a.m. when the sun hits the horizon, you've got no chance of capturing the image anyway. What I mean basically is the planning part is essential. Doing the footwork, making the extra effort to get out of bed before dawn is essential. But then the last part can very, very often be just down to luck. In episode 12, I discussed my digital workflow. In general, looking back at what I said, nothing has really changed. I still shoot RAW exclusively for the added freedom of being able to change settings like the Canon picture style and also white balance in post-processing, and also for the benefits of getting a 16-bit image as opposed to an 8-bit one that the JPEG image will produce. There's also the added benefits of the lossless compression, so the images are not compressed like a JPEG, and there's slightly better range with RAW images as well. There's other things, but I'm not going to go into all of that right now. I still very much hold to the rule of getting your exposure and composition right at the time of shooting, and rely very little on post-processing to adjust exposure. Cropping too much too will mean that you end up with a smaller image. So trying to get that right in the field, trying to get as much as you can right in the field really is essential, in my opinion. I tend to use Canon's Digital Photo Professional to export TIFF files so that I can import them to Photoshop rather than processing the images with Adobe Camera Raw plugin, because it still doesn't recognize Canon's picture styles. I believe that there's a problem on both sides of the fence there, getting in the way of making that happen. I did figure out how to set Adobe Camera Raw to give a very similar effect to the landscape picture style, but it's hit and miss and sometimes throws the colours way off. So I end up going back to Digital Photo Professional anyway. One other thing, I guess, is that I'm using the DVD backups much less now, as I find that the volume of images I have now just makes it impractical. I have two 250 gigabyte hard drives for my base copy now, and two more 250 gigabyte hard drives in an external unit that I attach and sync up at regular intervals. I leave the backup copy in the office for my day job and just take it home when I'm due to back up. This way, if a catastrophe hit, something like, you know, maybe a fire or even an earthquake, and I escape from it, assuming, I would hope that one of the backups stays intact. I'll also continue to make one full backup on DVD a year, probably, and send to my brother in the UK to keep for me as a final piece of insurance in case the whole of Tokyo goes down in an earthquake. If that happens, though, I'm probably not going to be around to worry about it too much, and my brother can start to make money off estate prints from the DVDs. In episode 13, we looked at a few images shot with a TSE 24mm lens. I've discussed shots since then made with the TSE lens, but I'd say that one of my favourites still remains image number 639 that we looked at, among others, in this episode. Many think that tilt-shift lenses are pretty much for straightening up buildings to stop the convergence, the tapering of the building towards the top as we look up at them from a low vantage point. And I do use my TSE lens for that too. But another artistic use of this lens is to make the scene look more like a macro shot of a tiny model than a photograph of reality. The reason this is possible is because you can use the tilt feature to on a tilt shift lens to move the focus plane of the lens from being parallel to the film plane to being any degree from zero, producing no effect, to almost 90 degrees from the film plane. Almost in line with the lens axis, that will be. What this means is that the depth of field in an image is no longer parallel to the camera, but running diagonal to it to some degree. Of course, you can use the shift feature to straighten elements like the vertical pillars in image number 639 as well, to stop it looking so obviously like we're looking down or up at our subject. And alternative to a relatively expensive tilt shift lens is the Lens Baby. I have tried both the original Lens Baby and the Lens Baby 2, and both are great fun and really inexpensive at less than $100. They are available for just about any camera that you can think of now, and I'll drop a link into the show notes for the Lens Baby website. It's basically though just lensbabies.com if you're interested in taking a look. In episode 14, I discussed white balance. I'd say that being able to balance the colour of images shot with a digital camera without using filters, as is necessary with film, say when using daylight film under artificial light, is probably one of the next big benefits of digital after being able to change the ISO for each frame without loading a different roll of film. We have to white balance to compensate for the colour of the light falling on a scene that we photograph, even when it's not obvious that the colour of the light is different, because our eyes very quickly adjust to our surroundings, and we do so subconsciously. We change, they will do the work for us. There's no switches to change it for us with our own eyes. There are times when we don't want to balance light. We would not, for example, want to balance out the warm glow of the sun at dawn or dusk. It would not really make much sense to do that. In these conditions, I use the daylight preset on my camera. I never use auto white balance, as although I believe it's getting much more accurate these days, I just don't like not being in control of the white balance. If you use the presets, you are in control. The one thing that has changed in my workflow with regards to white balance is that instead of using an old 18% grey card, I now use a Pocket YBAL. The YBAL is a small little card, basically, that has a number of options for attaching it to your clothing or around your neck for easy access. And I find myself just shooting it and setting my camera's custom white balance using that image for probably around a third of my work. When I want even more control than the presets would allow, that is. In addition to setting the custom white balance while shooting, if you use RAW, as I always do, you can just shoot the YBAL a few times during your shoot, especially when the light may change, and then set the rest of the images that were shot under the same light in post-processing, taking a reading from the single image that you shot. Again, though, I prefer to do as much as possible in the field to keep my post-processing down to a minimum. So I generally tend to set my custom white balance in the field. In episode 15, I discussed using a PL or a polarizing filter to remove the reflections on water, allowing us to see into the water more clearly. And the other thing that I touched on in this episode was the moral dilemma of whether or not we should help an animal that is nearing the end of its life, naturally that is, you know, about to die anyway, and not so much something that maybe, you know, the video footage that I've seen of the what was it? I think it was a duck or a goose walking along and its chicks fell down into a grating or a gutter. You know, I definitely couldn't stand and watch that happen, but when an animal is about to die anyway, do we intervene in any way? And that's a pretty in-depth thread. The forum thread that ensued on this very moral dilemma was very rich in various opinions. I won't go into the details now, as I would not be able to cover this topic enough again in a concise summary, but I will put a link to the thread in the show notes for those that are interested. In episode 16, we looked at adding an accent into your shots to add interest, and sometimes even something so small that it's not immediately obvious, giving the viewer that looks more deeply into your image an added bonus for their trouble. We looked at image 71, among others. In image 71, we can see the mighty Mount Fuji, an icon of Japan in all its glory. It's without a doubt the first thing that the viewer's eye will move to, filling most of the frame. However, once you've inspected the main subject and start to inspect the rest of the shot, you'll notice a person in a boat right there in the shadows. Although I've received many, many comments about this shot over the last few years, one of the most common comments has been, "I love the guy in the boat, it makes the shot." Keeping your eyes out for an additional element and positioning it in the right place will improve your images immensely. If the element is a moving object or an animal, shooting some insurance shots as it moves through your scene will pay off, but also waiting for it to move to the decisive point in the shot will make a big difference on the impact and the value that it adds to your image. Like I said earlier, though, it can really be down to luck whether or not this actually happens. You know, the added element moves to just the right place. But then again, you know, like I say, getting out there in the first place is down to you. In episode 17 and 18, I did two episodes giving tips for shooting in harsh winter conditions. For the first episode, I'd visited the Shirakawa-go, a small village with traditional houses with steep-sided roofs called Gassho-zukuri, which literally means built in the shape of praying hands. The Shirakawa-go village is a UNESCO World Cultural Heritage Site and an incredibly picturesque place to visit at any time of the year, but in winter it's simply amazing, even if it is quite a treacherous place to get to. Image number 782 was probably my best shot from the brief trip, with the orange persimmon fruit left on the branches of the tree in stark contrast to the bleak, snowy surroundings. I gave many other tips on shooting in harsh cold, such as putting your camera equipment in an airtight bag when taking it into a warm building from the cold to stop condensation from the warmth of the building forming on the internal elements of your lenses and your camera. I shoot in very cold conditions quite often, so many episodes do contain tips on shooting in the cold, but if you're heading off to a place, a sub-zero place yourself, listening to these two episodes would be a good place to start. In the second of these two podcasts, by the way, I used examples from a trip to the Inowashiro Lake in the Fukushima Prefecture, a week or so after the last shoot. From that, I showed you image number 809, which was probably my favourite shot from this day and a half or so of shooting. This, again, I guess this is coming up a few times today, but really this was my my bonus or my prize for getting up at the crack of dawn and going out onto an icy, wind-battered lake shore. Really, I forget the time exactly, but it was very early before the sun came up. And by the time I shot the shot that I just mentioned of the swans waking up and stretching their wings on one of the distant banks, I think that the sun was actually above the horizon, though it was behind cloud. But still a very moody shot with the layers of mist sort of getting thicker and thicker as they go into the background, and the wintry trees with the swans taking a very small part of the frame. But when you look at this on a large print, you know, they're there with the wings open, and it's really one of my favourite shots this year. In episode 19, we looked at an amazing sunset that we can see in image number 827 with Mount Fuji again. I was lucky, there's that word again, enough to witness this beautiful sunset, literally just in a few minutes breaking the clouds of an incredibly dramatic sky. In this episode, I also discussed visualization. I'd visited this location once around 4 years before the day I shot this sunset, and on my way down after a very long hike, I was going down a flight of stairs, and I realized that there was a car park really quite close to the top of this mountain. Although the climb up the steps would be a real lung buster, I committed this particular fact to memory for future reference. Having bought a car at the end of 2005, I decided to go back to this spot in the hope that I'd be able to shoot a nice sunset, and you can see the results, and I hope that you agree that it's more than just a nice sunset. We have the additional element of Mount Fuji in there and those amazing clouds. But one of the main points that I wanted to impress on you here was it's important to build a mental stock of locations like this to pull out of your hat at different times of the year to revisit. Many locations might not be perfect when you first find them. We might be there in the morning, for example, when the light would be better in the evening, or vice versa. The greenery might be drab when we see it and would look better when the fresh green foliage of spring or the colourful autumn leaves are on the trees. If necessary, keep a notebook of such locations and the times of day or the seasons in which you think you might like to revisit them. I find that looking back through old stock images regularly can also remind you of various locations and jog your memory for possible revisits too. Finally on this, visualization or visualizing the possibilities when you get there will also help you to decide what gear you need to take, which I need to get better at to stop myself from carrying just about every piece of equipment I own up the side of mountains. In episode 20 and 21, I discussed monitor calibration and printing with profiles. I don't really understand all of the technical details behind monitor calibration, so I basically just walk you through the steps that I go through to calibrate my monitor with the Spyder 2 Pro from Colorvision. Calibration is important because we need to know that any post-processing we do will give consistent results, not only against your own work, but against the monitors of others, assuming that they are also calibrated. What I mean by consistent work is, say if you have your monitor set too bright or too low contrast and say too green, for example, your results will probably end up too dark and too high a contrast and with weak greens because you'd probably be toning them down. Once you have your monitor calibrated, you can be sure that what you're looking at is the standard. So like I say, not only will your processing be more consistent, but other people that are looking at your images will also see them the same as long as they have calibrated monitors. One update is that I said that I could not create a separate profile for my second monitor, and I wasn't sure if it was down to the software or whatever, but this turned out to be that I had my video card software set to use my two screens as a single large screen. When I added a second video card to enable me to show my PC screen on my TV as a third screen, I was given the option to create a profile for all three screens individually, so the problem no longer exists. With regards to printing, I suggested using Adobe RGB as the color space when shooting and setting Photoshop to use Adobe RGB by default, as well as setting your camera to shoot in Adobe RGB, and that basically gives you the base colors that are available in the Adobe RGB color space or gamut, and more so than the smaller gamut of sRGB that most cameras use as a default. The main part that you lose is greens, and I think like lime greens. So probably some of the fresh greens that I was shooting in Oil Acid recently would not have been captured so brightly. So I would have hated to have lost that. There is a little more work involved when using Adobe RGB than sRGB, but if you want to use your images for anything other than viewing on the web, where sRGB is still the standard, the Adobe RGB color space would be your choice. It does mean that you have to convert to sRGB before publishing to the web, but this is just one line in an automation script in Photoshop and really is not a big overhead. Then I explained about soft proofing in Photoshop to see the results that various paper and print profiles will give you on screen before you actually go to printing it out. This helps you to select the right combinations and adjust the image if necessary before printing, and will save you time, the time to print and also the money it costs when you make mistakes. The same settings that we use in the soft proofing are what we would use when we make the final print. In episode 22, I discussed the composition style of using repeated patterns. And the first image that we looked at was one of mine from way back in 1992 of a row of striking white pillars in front of a red building with a nice blue sky. It is image number 16 on my website, a very early post, Repeating patterns are all around us in both man-made and natural forms. And although this is a relatively simple composition tip, it can produce some very pleasing results. What I tend to do is put one of the repeating elements very close to the camera, as with the first white pillar here that is taking up around 25% of the entire frame, and then let the other smaller objects flow into the distance, leading our eye into the shot. Next week we'll continue to summarize, starting with episode 23, and in that episode I discussed using telephoto lenses successfully. This podcast seems to me to be really not that far in the past now, especially not as far in the past as the ones I've discussed today and last week, so hopefully we'll really be able to pick up the pace even more by then. Remember that we are still voting for the Depicting Culture assignment, so if you haven't voted yet, please go to the mbpgalleries.com website and make your selection. You can change your selection if you change your mind as well, but it will remove the vote from your previous selection after asking you for confirmation, that is. Basically, each member only has one vote, but if you haven't exercised that right yet, please go along and choose one of your favorites from the amazing images that are on there right now and cast your vote. Have a great week, whatever you do. Thanks very much for listening. Bye bye. The Martin Bailey Photography Podcast is a member of the Photocast Network. Find other great photography-related podcasts at photocastnetwork.com.